under the soft ocean waves, exists an orchestra of movement. Invisible forces pull nutrients, plankton, and warmer water from one shore to another. A young boy in Florida picks up a bottle on his local beach. There's a message inside, with love from Scotland. A Hawaiian teenager untangles his surfboard from fishing nets lost off the coast of Thailand. All thanks to the push and pull of currents, movements which shape the great global ocean, the life within it, and the coastal communities alongside it, driving the migration of wildlife and the spread of ocean plastics across the globe. I'm Jerry Broughton. Welcome to What's Your Map? An Oculi Mundi exploration. In this podcast, we hear from those who live and love maps, making, preserving, interpreting, and being inspired by them. In each episode, we ask our guests to unfold a map that is special to them and to tell us the stories that lie behind it. To follow the map as we talk about it, go to oculi-mundi.com. We often think of maps as showing us land first and water second. But what if we map the world through its oceans first? After all, they make up 71% of the Earth's surface. Within the oceans, the lakes and the rivers, another world exists. And maps can tell us what's happening deep below the surface. Today's guest is an expert on marine conservation. She spent over 15 years protecting the delicate ecosystem of our oceans and other bodies of water, and is now a program director at the National Geographic Society. She leads on science-led and explorer-backed expeditions to some of the most remote places in the world to help vulnerable environments, whether that's because of the ravages of climate change or other human interventions. So many adventures and so many global challenges. Welcome, Elizabeth Hogan, to What's Your Map?
Thank you so much, Jerry. It's lovely to be here.
It is really great to have you here and looking at a very special map, which is pretty extraordinary, because I want you to tell me about this map that we're looking at. Mm-hmm. And first, just orientate me, because it's the world, really, from the perspective of the oceans. It's very, very weird to initially look at it.
It is.
Just let's look at it in detail and walk me through it. What are we looking at here?
We're looking at the world, but not the way we're accustomed to seeing it. There are so many things that I love about this map. It is ocean-centric. The land is the negative space, and you see the world's ocean, but you see it really as the one connected global ocean. So obviously there are five identified ocean basins in the world. We all learn about them in school, but seeing it like this, you really get a much greater appreciation for the fact that we do have this one global ocean and they are all connected. There are certain demarcations and barriers, mostly made up by human beings, that do exist, but it's one ocean. And this map reflects that beautifully, which I love.
What we're looking at here, it's surrounded by black. And then what you realize is the central portions, which are blue, are indeed the oceans. Right at the center here,
yes,
we have your place you're going to tell me about, Antarctica. Yes. And then you've got Australia, as I look at it, to the right, mm-hmm. and then Africa,
yes.
And Europe. But then surrounding it, quite yes. really weird, is, of course, more land, because this is a projection based on the ocean. So you round the corners, you have more land, in effect. This is really weird. So it's like a sort of, I'm trying to describe it, is it like an orange peeled inside out somehow?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I was thinking, you know, if you turned it upside down, which is the other thing I love about this map, it looks at it from the centerpiece of the South Pole, really. It puts Antarctica in the very center. And then as you said, the peels of the orange came away and you looked at it flattened out, but with Antarctica at the center, which means that all of the pieces in the northern half are very, very spread out and not as connected as we're accustomed to seeing them on a sphere. So, yeah, it is a very disorienting and unique way of looking at the world.
Where does this map come from?
Esri.
Yeah.
Esri made this map.
It's the Environmental Systems Research Institute. We also now see these beautiful sort of lines which yes. are crisscrossing this map as well, in sort of goldy yellows and then some blues, these kind of curves and these arcs.
Yes.
These are currents?
They are.
Just explain something about what we're seeing here with these currents. What do these show us?
The currents are showing us, and I believe the blue and the gold are based on direction, whether the water, to reflect the direction that the current is flowing in. But they, again, identify how connected the world's oceans are, because what starts in one place will end up someplace else. I have to confess to your audience that I am not a physical oceanographer, so I don't want to call myself an expert in ocean currents. However, I did gain an appreciation for them when I was working on the issue of ocean plastic, and particularly lost and abandoned fishing gear, because what I learned and spent many years dealing with is the fact that a piece of fishing gear that gets lost in a storm due to bad weather or any other reasons that gear might go missing, something that got lost off the coast of Florida in the United States wound up on the east coast of the United Kingdom, or things that get lost in Indonesia wind up in Hawaii. It happens all the time. So, yeah, something as light as plastic, although some fishing nets stretch for kilometers and are quite heavy, but regardless of weight or size, plastic can get lost in one corner of the globe and turn up in the other quite easily with a very short, much shorter amount of time than you would imagine it would take. So, yeah, currents really do connect the planet.
So when did you first come across this map, which is really oriented with the oceans at its center? And what was the impact for you in terms of the work that you do upon seeing it? What did it capture, make you go, aha, yes?
I first came across it only about 8 months ago. A colleague shared it with me at work. And first, I was struck by the orientation of it. As you said, it catches your eye right away. It makes you spend more time looking at it and really thinking about it. Just having to, place yourself within the context of it and think, wait, how does this work? But then the current lines also really drew me in, because it was such a clear depiction of so many things that I have worked on in the past and I'm working on now. And to see it all laid out like that, it just makes your brain race, like, okay, that explains why that batch of fishing gear from the Philippines showed up in this place over here. And that explains the migration of this whale species, at this time of year, because, of course, they're, following certain prey that is also migrating. And it makes sense that that's the direction they move. It just sent my brain spinning.
We don't have five oceans. We have one.
Yes, exactly. One global ocean.
Which are all connected. So talk to me about this sense of, because my understanding is the way in which we've now realized, that there is a Southern Ocean, which,
yes,
I guess many people won't think that we talk about a Southern Ocean. What does that mean to talk about a Southern Ocean?
I believe that it was formally named in 2021. And so I grew up thinking that, the world has four oceans, because that was what I learned in school. And so it was quite popular in the news at the time that, like, a fifth ocean has been named. And it really did draw attention to Antarctica and that region of the world, which I was happy about, because there is so much that's fascinating about that ocean. And it is very distinct and unique in that the Antarctic Circumpolar Current really does isolate that region, demarcates it very firmly. So that is the current that forms a complete closed circle around the Antarctic continent. It's fascinating that there is this one ocean, the Southern Ocean, that borders three other oceans and connects them all in a way, because that current makes a complete loop all the way around the Antarctic continent. It really does form even more of a border than any of the other oceans have. And what I find most fascinating about that is that the existence of that current and its circumpolar nature is that it really retains a population of over 10,000 endemic species that just live in the Southern Ocean. So it really does create its own eco world in that one ocean.
And this fascinating situation of what's happening with the meeting of cold water and warmer water, mm-hmm, and how this is sort of creating this amazing ecosystem, which I didn't really know about, and the dangers in terms of the changes in climate. Can you just explain that to me? Because I found that absolutely extraordinary and terrifying.
Well, currents are what move nutrients throughout the water, and they also move temperature shifts throughout the water. So it does, currents, all of these currents are delivering colder water to warmer places or warmer water to colder places, and it regulates the temperature, and it creates a regulated environment for certain nutrients and certain species to thrive. for the Antarctic Circumpolar Current to form that closed loop around the Southern Ocean, it does mean that a whole food web and food chain that can thrive in the conditions specific to that ocean really have a nice enclosed safe haven there. However, because the planet is warming, more fresh water is beginning to enter the ocean. And with the addition of fresh water, you are diluting the salt, the saltier, denser water of the ocean. And by diluting that saltier, denser water, it has the effect of weakening currents. And so as we weaken the currents, it means certain nutrients aren't getting to where they need to go. And it does pose a risk to the food chain in several places.
And this knock-on effect is really, I think, what the map is showing, mm-hmm. right? Because it's showing that you can't, you, I guess you can work on the Atlantic or the Pacific, but you cannot see them in isolation. And I guess this is the way in which your work has been going and what's happening.
Well, you will have a deeper layer of fresh water sitting at the surface of the ocean. Fresh water is less dense than salt water. And as more fresh water enters the ocean because there is more rain, increased precipitation, and the melting of ice caps at sea, or melting of ice on land that then increases rivers that then make their way to the ocean, which carries sediment with it, which further changes the chemistry of the ocean. But the addition of all of this fresh water and this rapid addition of fresh water means that more and more fresh water is stacking up on the surface of the water. And that has several knock-on effects. So one of which is that heightened layer of fresh water at the top means that the marine layer is further and further from sunlight. And so less sunlight means less phytoplankton, means less energy, means less food. So that's one element. It also means that the top layer of the ocean is getting hotter because it's more and more fresh water. So you're having more of a stratification effect in the ocean with this warmer and warmer layer sitting on top, which means there's less mixing, which is, again, what brings nutrients to the surface. And that also impacts the currents that way as well. And then you have to think about not just, there's animals and there's the environment. And then think about coastal communities who are accustomed to their immediate environment functioning a certain way. That warmer water can sometimes lead to things like bleaching events, and coral reefs, you know, house 25% of life in the ocean. So if the reefs are dying, then that too impacts fish, which means less food. So all of these effects mean less life in the ocean. And as we can see based on this map, it's all interconnected, and that ocean impacts the entire planet.
I love this idea that the global ocean is like a conveyor belt. And I believe that the projections, based on the kind of work that you've been looking at, is that that current will be 20% slower by 2050 as the world warms. That seems pretty catastrophic. I mean, can you just give me a sense of what that could mean?
There are many different projections as to what that could mean. I don't know if that 20% stat, if we will reach that at 2050 or not, that would be quite significant. The first change that comes to mind is that what protects the ecosystem of the Southern Ocean will be that much weaker, and it would mean that the food chain for the Southern Ocean will be greatly disrupted. It will alter the migratory paths of many, many, many species. So if that area is suddenly getting an influx of warmer water, perhaps due to a potential change of that magnitude in this current, there's nowhere colder for those species to go. So what happens then? I don't know.
Can you give me a sense of how this kind of information and data and the sort of work that you're doing is having an impact? I mean, is this understood more widely and also within not just scientific communities, but then I guess on the ground with activists, with NGOs that are working to respond to it? Tell me about the need to reduce emissions. There seems to be within the scientific community, obviously, an understanding of the importance of that. Mm-hmm. How do you see that going? Where are we at with that? I mean, just give me a sense of that. Mm. Are you feeling upbeat? Oh, dear. I'm not getting a sense of that. But how does it look from your perspective?
It's funny because there are so many causes for hope and yet other reasons for concern. And I would say it seems that we've entered an era where having a strong scientific background means that you maybe are not worth listening to, whereas I would have liked to think that scientists should be heard. So really that's down to various governments and who is in charge of making the decisions and what those decisions are based on. Sometimes they're based on science and sometimes they're not. So while I know that there are many human beings on the planet that do care about it and care about their children and their grandchildren and want to ensure that the planet can continue to support beautiful ecosystems and species other than just our own, as well as the human race, that doesn't always rule the day when it comes to policy decisions. So, you know, every country on the planet gets to make their own decisions, and some are moving in the direction towards sustainability and others are not. And I'm sure that those distinctions will continue to ebb and flow for years to come.
Listeners, isn't Elizabeth's passion for our oceans so captivating and infectious? But before we continue and delve more into her career, I'd love you to join our global community of explorers by subscribing to this podcast. From mapping the cosmos to building a new image of the world, we have a wealth of episodes for you to enjoy. And subscribing means you won't miss a single new map, guest, or story from this series or the next. Now, back to Elizabeth and our blue planet. Let's look again at this map and think about your history.
Okay.
And you've been lucky enough to go on some extraordinary expeditions. Actually, let's just have a few pointers here. Where have you been on this map?
Oh, my goodness. I'm very fortunate.
Where have you not been?
I've been so fortunate with the travel I've gotten to do in my life. And I realized 2024 was a very fortuitous year for me, because in 2024, I went to all five of the world's oceans in that single year. I got to all five, which was incredible. And also in 2024, I made it to my seventh and final continent, which was Antarctica.
Marvelous. We can say you have been all over this map, which is rather
yes.
good.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about your career and how you got into marine conservation and obviously the passion of that work.
Yeah.
What's the backstory?
I grew up in New England, in the United States. So I was very lucky to have a lot of exposure to the ocean as a child, which I always, always loved. I always loved the smell of a dock, the smell of the ocean and the feeling of standing on a dock and staring at the water and just the feeling of being about to get on a boat just always made me so incredibly happy. So it was always something that was in my head growing up. I knew I loved the ocean. I loved ocean animals. I fell in love with whales and sharks at an early age. They just always fascinated me. And when I was applying to university, most of the colleges that I applied to, I applied as a biology major, except for one, which was right here in Washington, D.C., Georgetown University. And the other thing that I have always loved and been fascinated by, as you pointed out from the map, is seeing the world. And I was very torn between going the scientific route or looking at international policy and trying to heal the world from that perspective. So when I was accepted into Georgetown University's Foreign Service School, I looked at international environmental policy, and I studied that, international law of the sea, all those sorts of courses. And so I had, you know, my bachelor's degree was much more in an international environmental policy zone than it was the harder sciences. I lived in Ecuador for a while after I had graduated from university. And
why were you in Ecuador? What were you doing in Ecuador?
It was an adventure. I was just there working. But, you know, about half the Ecuadorian population are shrimp fishermen living on the coast. And I was very drawn to that. And it happened to be an El Nino year when I was there, and seeing the devastation that El Nino caused for the fishermen and the families that depend on those shrimp fisheries. And the water was too warm. The fish had all migrated. And at the same time that there's nothing for fishermen to catch, the surge of the water from the El Nino effect on the Pacific Ocean meant that, you know, their homes were being wiped out on the coast, and it meant the coastal road systems were being wiped out. And just seeing all of the devastation caused by these changes in the ocean and what the migration of fish in responding to these warmer waters, what it meant, it definitely inspired me to want to have the harder science background as well. So I applied to graduate school. One degree that I pursued was in marine and coastal natural resources at a university in Costa Rica. So I again got to work with coastal fishermen in Latin America, and it was a wonderful experience. And so that doing my graduate work gave me much more of the scientific background that I needed.
Okay, I want to get you to Antarctica, but first I want to get you via the North Atlantic. Tell me about working, because one of the research projects, I believe quite earlier on, was the North Atlantic right whale.
Yes.
Tell me about working with the North Atlantic right whales.
So it comes about because my first job out of graduate school was with the International Fund for Animal Welfare, IFAW, and my very first assignment, the first species I was assigned to was the North Atlantic right whale, which I was thrilled about because the North Atlantic right whale, there's only approximately 350 of them left in the world, which is quite scary. It's a very low number to the extent that the entire population is named. Like every individual in the population has a unique name that is known. But that number has held fairly steady for the last, let's see, since 2008. So it was about 350 when I started working on them at that point in time. And I've seen it go up to 420, and I've seen it go down to about 320, but it's still hovering at about 350, I believe. Someone might be able to fact check me on that, give or take a whale or two. The part of the draw, I mean, it was the assignment I was given when I went to work at the organization, but I was also pretty excited about it because the North Atlantic right whale lives off the coast of New England, and I felt this connection to it. And as I'd mentioned earlier, I always loved the smell of being on the docks at the ocean, and I loved seeing the fishing boats come and go. And one of the greatest perils to being a North Atlantic right whale, they got their name because they were considered the right, I'm using air quotes for people who can't see me,
yes,
the right whale to hunt because they would stay very close to shore.
Oh.
And surface frequently, so they were easy for hunters to catch.
Nice.
Yes, unfortunately. And, you know, that species is certainly not hunted today. However, also along the coastline of the northern United States are an awful lot of fisheries, especially lobster fisheries. And I was really fascinated by the issue of the lobster traps, lobster fisheries, and the issue of entanglement, which is putting the whales at risk. And lobster pots are often connected through a rope called a ground line that is then attached to a buoy. So a fisherman can put several lobster pots overboard attached to a single buoy and that way haul in anywhere from 10 to 25 pots at the same time. This ground line that connects the traps is what the whales would become entangled in. And the entanglement injuries are awful. You hate to see it. It often means a very slow and painful existence for the animal because traps weigh a lot. And they will, you know, the animals, they're mammals. They have to surface to breathe air. So the traps will get wrapped around the animal and the animal will, you know, eventually either have a severe injury because the rope that's used, it's made of plastic. And so, you know, that the strongest muscle on the planet is the tail of a blue whale, and the tail of a blue whale still can't break through monofilament plastic fishing line. So, yeah.
That's quite a stat both ways.
I know. And so how do we fix this? Plastic is durable. It's, you know, for fishermen, like, it's expensive, the fishing gear. They have to pay that out of pocket. It's cash up front. That's not easy. And so they don't want the gear to wear out. And I remember when we first started working on that issue that year, the first thing the fisherman said was, if we switch from the ground line that floats in the water column where the whales are getting entangled and it sits on the seafloor instead, that's rocky substrate, the lines are going to break, and we're just going to have to replace the gear over and over and over again, which is going to cost a lot of money and isn't going to do a whole lot of good. And they were right. All the negotiations led to them having to change their gear, which did cost them more money and led to the gear wearing out just like they said it would. And they were right. It's not an easy problem to solve.
Give me a sense of some of the expeditions that you've been on recently, because they're quite extensive. So tell me, as it were, where are those trips that you've been on the map, back on this map?
Oh, goodness, on this map.
Where have we been?
So I've been on an awful lot of fishing boats around North America, especially in the Gulf of Maine and the Gulf of Alaska. I'd been there for different reasons, both disentangling animals from plastic, sea lions, mostly stellar sea lions, and doing observational work on fishing boats, research studies on ghost gear, how often gear gets lost or intentionally abandoned, where is that most likely to happen, why it happens. Ghost gear, while I've worked on the ocean plastic issue at large, the lost and abandoned fishing gear is the most dangerous form of ocean plastic because it was designed to trap and kill. And if it gets lost and is floating around the ocean, it continues to do that. And you don't know where it is or where it's gone, but it will continue to kill animals over and over and over again for its existence. And now that gear is not being made from the old-fashioned, you know, type of sisal rope that it used to come from, but is now made of plastic, which will endure for hundreds and hundreds of years. It's quite a lethal thing to have in the oceans. It can smother a reef, take down the largest blue whale. It can cause an awful lot of damage. Sorry, I can really bring the mood down anywhere I go. It's quite a skill.
But you've been also more recently in the Amazon as well, working in the Amazon.
Yes, I have gotten to.
What was the Amazon expedition about?
The Amazon expedition... So anyone out there who has access to Disney Plus, if I can put in a shameless plug for our work, Expedition Amazon is the expedition that I had the enormous privilege of working on through my current role. And I got to work with the most wonderful group of National Geographic explorers, all scientists across multiple disciplines. And it was very exciting for me because, it was honestly a major learning opportunity because my career until then had focused entirely on marine life. And this was aquatic life. So most of my background was in marine mammals and occasionally marine reptiles, which is really just a fancy way of saying turtles, the occasional iguana. In the Amazon, it was mammal species, but aquatic mammals. So the pink-boda river dolphin, which had always fascinated me, the Dafushi dolphin.
Dolphins.
Manatees, which I had my heart set on seeing and did not see a one. They're a veterinarian on that trip who I was very lucky to get to work with. Used to say to me, they're like ghosts. But the pink dolphins and the arapaima fish, and the giant Amazon tortoise and the jacare, the big Amazonian crocodiles, I got to see all of them very up close. Crocodiles tag closer than I intended to see. They're very imposing, by the way, when you're in a tiny, tiny canoe.
You don't say.
Oh, yeah, I do. I do say. especially at night because their eyes glow red. They do. They glow red. You couldn't come up with like a better, more menacing, like movie type of creature to just make you a little. They do.
Why
I'm not making it up.
Why were you in the dark in a canoe with the red eyes?
Because there was a very bad storm and we didn't get back to the boat until later than we intended. And there was this massive rainstorm. It's pitch black. And we're just in the canoe and like heading back to the boat and soaking wet and trying to keep the equipment dry. And someone took a photograph of me and two colleagues at the moment that a flash of lightning hit and we saw the eyes and all three of our faces look absolutely ridiculous. I mean, it's funny when you see it. It truly is because all three of us have just our most scared out of our wits faces on. And we look, we don't exactly look confident.
Is this when you decide to go to the Antarctica and you're on it? Maybe perhaps shake it up a bit.
I think the only thing I was thinking at that moment in time was, where is a towel and a cup of coffee? That was all I wanted. I just wanted to dry off.
That's going to help you with the crocodiles. Now, let's talk about the Antarctic instead, as we don't have crocodiles there. You were there recently. What was that expedition about?
That was a wonderful scientific research expedition with five different teams of scientists, cross-disciplinary again. And we're looking at the... trying to get a sense of the overall health of the whole ecosystem. So we had scientists who were focusing on seeps below the seafloor, like the very deepest parts of the ocean, and some that were looking at sea ice and, you know, phytoplankton growing underneath the ice. And some were looking at seals and penguins, the, you know, animals living on top of the ice, and others looking at, fish that live in the pelagic zone in the water column. Others looking at, you know, the vegetation or the invertebrates that grow on the seafloor. So it was wonderful to see the entire range of all of those studies coming together. And to see everyone thinking about how their work impacted the work of the person next to them. And so the collaborations that emerged from it were fascinating, like all the way from the microbes up to, you know, the large leopard seals. It was such an incredible privilege to be there.
And is it your proudest moment? I mean, in terms of both what you've achieved and I guess where you've traveled, what would be those highlights for you? What the best place, where would that be? Would it have been the Antarctic?
It might be, simply because it was such a lifelong dream and I couldn't have traveled with better people, honestly. Mm. Yeah, words fail me, obviously, as you can hear me hesitating right now. I wish I had the perfect word or words to describe it. It was very much a dream come true.
You're obviously very passionate and invested in the work, obviously. If you were speaking, I guess, on this kind of podcast, what would be the big thing that you would want to emphasize, I guess, looking back at the map as well, in terms of the work that you're doing to try and get across that sense of what's going on with the oceans? For you, what would be that message?
If you have the chance to just step outside for even a few seconds a day, a few seconds a week, a month, to just think about the wider planet and how you live and what you can do, because we can all do something. I have three little nieces and I want them to see the things that I've seen. I want them to love the planet the way I love the planet, and I want it to still be functioning for them when they're the age that I am now. And, you know, when you see species that once used to be abundant and now you feel lucky if you see one or two over the course of a week in a location, it's sad. And, you know, it's no human being is powerless, no matter how we think of, well, yeah, it's I'm sure someone somewhere is working on that issue. There are people working on that issue, but we still need you to care. So I guess I would say that.
I'm also quite struck by what little we seem to know when we look at this map. Elizabeth Hogan, thank you so much for joining me on What's Your Map and showing me this very beautiful and very, very different map of the world from the oceans rather than from the land. Elizabeth, thank you.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much, Jerry. It was lovely to talk to you.
From being surrounded by crocodiles to exploring the ice-cold Antarctic, I'm not quite sure if I envy Elizabeth Hogan, but I do know that she's doing amazing things for our planet, and we can certainly all make a difference. I'm Jerry Broughton. Thank you so much for listening. This has been an Oculi Mundi exploration. The producer is Emily Uchida Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. Oculi Mundi is the online home of the Sunderland collection of antique maps and atlases. You can read more about the collection, see the maps from this podcast, and send suggestions for future maps at oculi-mundi.com. I look forward to your company next episode, when Iris Taylor will be sharing a remarkable, recently unearthed map of African-American culture. Until then, thanks for listening.